You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today's program is being recorded in the evening of the 12th of March, 2025. And today's topic is going to be North Korea. North Korea that, despite not necessarily being on the front page every single day like it used to be, remains extremely important. And I'm never going to allow the press to decide for me what's important and what isn't. The mere fact that something isn't on the front page doesn't mean very much to me, as far as what we're talking about and what we're not talking about. Now, regardless of what you may think of the North Korean system, whether it's Marxist or not, whether it's Stalinist or not, how radically it's changing, whether it's changing enough, you have to respect its ability to survive. There's a new book out, actually came out this year, called Surviving the Unipolar Era, North Korea's 35-Year Standoff with the U.S. by A.B. Abrams, which is mostly a work of history. It does bring itself to the present era by explaining the American weakness and how North Korea, among many other places, show how weak the U.S. is militarily, diplomatically, and economically. North Korean government has been impressive in terms of how it's dealt with the United States. Its recent security measures and alliances, of course, longstanding with the Chinese, and now over the last 6-9 months with Russia, have been pretty brilliant, diplomatically speaking. The DPRK has come to realize, though, that yes, it does have a nuclear arsenal, but this could never take away from its the significance of conventional weaponry. That low-level conventional attacks could undercut whatever whatever superiority or whatever deterrent it may have in East Asia as far as nuclear weapons are concerned. What some are calling a bloody nose strike, especially now as South Korea is in some serious trouble economically and diplomatically itself. Its arsenal, its scientific acumen, its nationalism, its racialism is in fact something to be admired. But the regime itself, fully acknowledged now, like say after March of 2023, nuclear warheads as well as the development of drones, the regime will admit that the North is capable of knocking out its bases in Guam, Hawaii, even parts of the 7th Fleet in Japan. Now, as I've been saying for many years, the U.S. is very poorly equipped when it comes to dealing with conventional warfare against major militaries, that is to say, regular militaries, not guerrilla forces, not irregular forces. But North Korea represents, as Abrams says, one of the most direct contradictions to the idea of this new world order centered on the economic and military power of the Western world and the global triumph of Western values of what I've called, broadly speaking, the regime. So on the one hand, the regime wants to paint it as this bizarre alien force, but still having to admit that it retains the military capacity to devastate cities across the Western world. And that because of Russian technological superiority to the U.S. in terms of hypersonic missiles, that means that both the Chinese, now the Chinese have quite literally flown away with now the 6th generation J fighter, fighter bomber, actually. And as far as missiles go, the Hwasong 16B, the IRBM, solid fuel design, meaning that it's fully battle ready, doesn't require a refueling process, and that this thing has been launched already, that North Korea now is ahead of the U.S. in terms of hypersonic missiles. But North Korea's been test firing these as far back as September of 21. And unlike the American version, the North Korean versions were successful. So what occurred last year, the alliance between North Korea and Russia, that just formalized something that had already existed. And it's put on the front page like it's something new. But if you've been listening to me, you realize that there's nothing new about that whatsoever. And it gets pretty old to hear the regime, the propaganda regime, trying to ridicule the superiority of the Eastern world over the Western in many areas of high technology, especially with, I guess it's the J-30. And it's shocking even to someone like me who you hear every week there's a new weapon system coming out of China. This massive navy and these new forms of ships, these new forms of missiles and drones that no one has thought of before. Now you have a situation where it's in the interest of both the Russians and the Chinese to keep Pyongyang safe. But the Hwasong 16B is very similar to the Chinese DF-17 and very well equipped. So, but don't let this fool you. There are no North Korean troops fighting for Moscow in Ukraine, or has it ever been a necessity? But the Pentagon can't match what even North Korea is putting out in this regard. Pyongyang will adopt a more proactive military doctrine to push back against the regime's aggression in Asia-Pacific, where at least as far as Donald Trump's priorities are concerned, to pull away from the West and pull away from Russia and move that effort to the East, suggesting, of course, that the U.S. can only function in one theater at a time, which is something that a superpower should be able to do, or shouldn't be forced into. A superpower should be able to fight on numerous fronts, but it simply cannot. But the South Korean CIA, it's now what's called the National Intelligence Service, claims that 12,000 North Korean infantry are fighting in the Russian military. Apparently, these people don't know how that has to work. You have to have a unified command speaking both languages, or it doesn't work at all. Zelensky tried to make that claim roughly about this time last year, maybe more like 9 months ago, creating this story that democratic Ukraine, which of course is a one-party state, is at war with the three dictatorships of Russia, Iran, and North Korea. That the beacon of democracy is, in fact, a one-party state that's defending Europe and the civilized, multiracial European world from these hordes of autocracy and racism. They're even inventing stories that the North Koreans are already deserting and they're being sent to penal units and everything else. The South Koreans are coming up with all kinds of proof as its system shows itself in very serious trouble compared to what it was just a decade ago or prior to 1997, though much longer than that, that these Koreans now are being used to drive Ukrainian forces out of Kursk. If you remember, the UN representative for the UK, Barbara Woodward, a complete airhead, however you want to slice it, said that the harder Putin finds it to recruit Russians to be cannon fodder, the more willing it is to rely on the DPRK. Now, there's no agreement as to the numbers that are there, but even if it's something like 10,000 or 12,000, it's not enough to really do anything, so it's simply propaganda regardless. It doesn't make any sense for it to be true, therefore it isn't true. But these inconsistencies don't mean very much. Importantly, it should be noted that North Korea as well as Russians have learned from Iraq and Libya that trying to satisfy the liberal powers is out of the question, because the U.S. liberalism wants nothing other than the total destruction of its opponents. It's not merely that they are defeated. It's they are completely annihilated, completely destroyed. We talked about that in terms of Syria. God Almighty, we've talked about that relative to the Third Reich. Nothing has changed in this kind of mentality. We can't judge the North Korean system based on what happened in the 1990s, but you have a lot of idiots who are, in fact, doing just that. The food crisis had nothing to do with its economic system at all, but it had more to do with floods, the merciless destruction of local infrastructure. They were not systematic problems. They were the result of natural disasters. It had nothing to do with the system or mismanagement or anything else. Keep in mind that only about 15% of the DPRK has arable land. But also, it's heavily affected by very cold temperatures, the growing season being very short. It's very much like Russia, in fact. In the early 90s, the energy imports from the USSR had almost entirely collapsed. All at the same time this is going on, the floods destroyed 70% of its already existing energy-producing plants. But prior to that, let's keep in mind, there was an overproduction of food in North Korea. The floods of the early 90s didn't just destroy agriculture, but destroyed its reserves, something like 2 million tons of grain. And they were put on, of course, forcibly put on a daily ration. I think I've mentioned this before at one time or another, but it's extremely important. But people like Andrei Lankov, really someone who was there, someone who was allowed to analyze the situation, he's at the University in South Korea now, someone who I rely on, says that the best estimate of the losses back then were about 650,000 over and above what would have been, who would have died normally. Yeah, excess mortality, in other words. However, the famine and the resulting social crisis did bring about what we can call a new economy, especially as it developed near the Chinese border, one basically in private hands. So yes, from 1990 to 2000, industrial production fell by half, but the slack was taken up in places that were not necessarily recorded by anybody. The fact that North Korea is by necessity quite secretive means that none of this is really fully understood. Traditional agriculture there in North Korea is a matriarchal system, but it came into existence or resurfaced in this period of time and became a critical part of its infrastructure. Now, by 10 years ago, 2014, 2015, DPRK was back to its normal grain tonnage. Since that famine, since the flooding, DPRK has grown roughly 2% a year, according to the Central Bank of Korea in Seoul. Although, again, this is basically a guess. The growth of both China and Russia in their illiberal paths, very successful paths, have also brought the North Koreans along with it. Russia has been involved in updating the North Korea's oil refining and transport infrastructure, its military-based modernization projects, joint concerns of both Moscow and Peking. North Korea's economic growth is to a great extent due to Russian investment in all areas, not merely energy. Don't make the mistake of reducing Russian investment and Russian development to energy. That's a fairly small percentage of its growth. It is a normal economy in every sense, certainly far more normal and stable and diverse than in the U.S. or Western Europe. But 10 years ago, Russian investment in North Korea just started, $25 billion in 2014 alone. And if anybody is expert in rebuilding war-torn areas, the Russians and the North Koreans certainly are. Because prior to the fall of Assad in Syria, Chinese, Russian, and North Korean laborers were involved in rebuilding much of Syria. Of course, that's all gone now. I think the myth of North Korean soldiers came from the existence of North Korean specialists who did come in to help rebuild war-torn areas in parts of eastern Ukraine. But they have a very specialized form of worker dealing with building something that had been destroyed by warfare. That did exist, but it had no military, or at least no directly military application. But part of the reason that there is this war declared on the DPRK, certainly it's not, however you want to, I don't know how you want to define the system, social nationalist, National Bolshevik maybe is probably the better way of putting it. It is developing very quickly. Keep in mind that you can't develop militarily without developing in every other way. The ultimate nightmare of the regime is having a first world society come into existence on the basis of both non or even anti-liberal approaches to economics, especially when it's done against, in the face of, economic sanctions. Sanctions have been a boon to the Russian economy. They're now a boon to the Chinese economy. For the U.S., putting sanctions on the Chinese economy makes me smile, because the assumption is the U.S. is in a superior position. No, the Chinese put sanctions on the American economy, not the other way around. The U.S. is not in a position of strength relative to China. The U.S. needs the Chinese more than China needs the United States. It's the East that's developing, not the West. Now, I also don't want to make the error of talking about like the 60s and 70s in North Korea, where you have tremendous industrial development based on Soviet and thus American assistance. You're talking about 10 to 20% growth a year in the 60s and 1970s. 15% growth yearly by the mid-70s. But as the Soviet system began to weaken, so did the DPRK. And of course, in the 1990s, it all came crashing down. Now, as I've mentioned at least two or three times systematically on this broadcast or in the Orthodox Nationalist, things like poverty, first world status, third world status, and maybe this is time I should point this out. I still use first, second, third world. In academia, they don't want to use this anymore. Ultimately, it comes down to this. The first world referred to Western Europe and the United States and those attached to it. It would include Japan, South Korea, Canada. The second world was the old Soviet Union, while it still existed. Later on, it may have included China and anything coming out of the former Soviet system, no matter where it might be found. The third world is everybody else. Now, of course, any of the social scientific terms, you have plenty of third world economies in Europe. You have plenty of first world economies in Asia. The second world always has been this strange, very illiberal manifestation. One of the reasons that it's not used anymore, because the Western economic establishment doesn't understand it. The second world now is basically the social nationalist world, of which to some extent, or even the national Bolshevik world, if you want to call it the North Korean version, that. So when you use these terms, and I do, versus, you know, the more liberal conception of, you know, the Western liberal world and then everybody else, the first, second, third world, and sometimes even the fourth world, which would include, in my opinion, places like Ukraine, Albania, and much of West Africa, Central Africa, just even lower than the third world in terms of sheer poverty and almost hopelessness in the short term of ever coming out of this poverty, is that the multilateral approach to the world makes more sense when you use the world's first, second, third, fourth versus the more modern version of the developed versus the undeveloped, or even stupid slogans like the global south, which all, you know, that's as imprecise as the third and fourth worlds. The global south, well, Moldova is part of the global south. If you're going to use it as an economic, as would be Albania and even some of Georgia. So, and the U.S. certainly, racially speaking, has as much connection with the third world as it does the first. You know, the concept of the first world was an industrialized economy. The Western world is largely deindustrialized, has now third world people invading it successfully and colonizing chunks of it. Therefore, calling the former first world third world is not that insane. And it's, you know, it's done quite deliberately. But the system's a success of any particular system seems to have nothing to do with markets or so-called capitalism, because the most successful and stable systems are illiberal ones. But let me go back to where we started before I went off on the tangent on the three worlds, because it is very important. I use this terminology all the time, and I might as well get it out there. But, and that's what I mean by these phrases. I'm going to continue to use them, whatever the academics may say about it. But I want to quote a Henri Ferrand, a French specialist in North Korea, although being a specialist in North Korea is kind of strange. But he says this. He says, the common prejudice that North Korea must be one of the poorest countries in the world is based on a highly speculative and likely politicized GDP estimate. Comparatively speaking, our most reliable indicators are food production and trade statistics, and both indicate that North Korea is doing much better than in the 1990s, during the post-Soviet economic crisis. Data locally collected by the World Food Program indicates that North Korea is now more or less back to the nutritional self-sufficiency of the 1980s, and has considerably decreased key indicators of chronic undernutrition, stunting, and wasting. Now, that is the case when you have very severe traumas, like the DPRK went through in the 1990s. Any society would go through that. Now, as I say almost every talk anymore, when it deals with contemporary issues, the media sensationalism, I mean, you can't allow the media to determine what's successful, what isn't, what works, and what doesn't. Journalists have no specialized knowledge in anything. They go where they're told to go. They love using words like collapse, except when they're dealing with the West, of course. They love using words like depression, except when they're dealing with themselves, where they're not allowed to use those words. But they love the sensational terminology, but only so far as it's talking about the enemies of the liberal order. So they talk about the coming collapse of Russia, China, and North Korea. They've been talking about that for now a decade and a half at least. It is a form of neurotic projection. And it's a way to understand both policy and the rhetoric coming from the regime. The one place that it is a possibility would be the Western world. Not China, not North Korea, not Russia, but the Western world. The axis of resistance of which North Korea is a part. Far more stable than the U.S., the EU. The other problem I have is that I don't like in the BRICS system, I don't refer to it very often. I'm not a big fan of having South Africa as a part of this. South Africa was only the part of the axis of resistance when it was under white rule. Under black rule, it's now fourth world. It's taken all the gains of white rule, both in terms of industry, the scientific establishment, and completely destroyed them. I have a huge problem, and this goes for Russian policy as well as anybody else, trying to pretend somehow that the current South African government and economy is part of the axis of resistance. It's no such thing. The present destruction, third worldization, or even fourth worldization of South Africa came from the regime. It doesn't have any, it's not an opposition to it, it's the creation of it. So BRICS is very incoherent to me. Unlike Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which makes more sense, I think BRICS is just very incoherent. And the more countries that join it, the less coherent it's going to be, because you don't have an axis of resistance in BRICS anymore, unless it's really completely focused around the Sino-Russian axis with assistance from Central Asia, you know, places like Iran, Belarus, but then you start adding other places. You know, Turkey wants to be a part of it. Even European countries want to be a part of it. Now, it's, you know, we talked about, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, how the EU, in trying to get away from Donald Trump's America, should try to join BRICS, which would completely destroy its purpose. But the more new members it gets, the less coherent its presence in the world is going to be. And I think right now the BRICS organization is way too liberal in terms of who it brings in without reference to its presence in the world, which is meant to be part of the axis of resistance, which is a national socialist or national Bolshevik mentality in some variation, very, very broadly speaking. Anyway, but as far as North Korea is concerned, what is impressive is that while it was in its 1990s crisis, which again, unlike the Soviet version, was not systemic, was not institutionalized. It came about as a result, I mean, partially because of the Soviet collapse, But North Korea would have fallen in on itself regardless, given the floods and the terrible climatological conditions that it was forced to live under. But it was during, and it often is, during periods of crisis that a nation shows its mettle. This is why nationalism, ethno-nationalism, is so essentially important, critical. Because unless you have that kind of social trust, where you see yourself in others, you don't see an enemy in others, you see yourself in others. That's what ethnicity is. You know, essentially an expanded family, an extended family. If you don't have social trust, you're not going to get through catastrophes like this. We could talk about the Great Depression. I think the U.S. economy is worse than it was during the Great Depression. But during the Great Depression, you had a very different American society. People would go rummaging through garbage cans, but they made sure they had a tie and jacket on. As dirty as it may have been, they had that level of self-respect. They were very proud of who they were, racially, ethnically, the U.S. as a whole, as an institution, and everything that it meant. You know, it was a very different country in 1935 versus what it is in 2025. You can't talk about it being the same country at all, in fact. That's why all this nonsense about, you know, immigrants coming to America in, let's say, from 1900 to the 1930s. Well, first of all, you're talking about a completely different group of immigrants and a completely different society that they're immigrating towards. Two completely different entities. The U.S. that is taking millions from Mexico by force is not the same U.S. that existed 100 years ago. So there is no comparison. And that fits in perfectly with what I'm talking about in terms of poverty as a relative measure for this very reason. Poverty is extreme when you don't have the level of social trust that would lead to people sacrificing for one another. That's a kind of wealth that you really can't put a dollar sign on, but it's something that's very real that you can experience directly. North Korea, being 100% Korean, has that level of social trust. It's something that Americans will never understand. When the regime talks about the democracy that's standing up to the Asiatic hordes of racism, you know, they're talking about the multicultural, multisexual regime standing up against societies that have learned that the Western ideologies, whether Marxist or liberal, that it had adopted at one point are failures. And they have come to rely on each other. And the fact that North Korea is racially singular is part of the reason that they were able to come through. It has nothing to do with revolution, the revolutionary spirit of self-reliance, like Kim Il-sung used to talk about. That's not relevant. Yeah, self-reliance already is based on this racial, ethnic, linguistic connection that builds a population to be what it is, what makes a Korean a Korean. What makes an American, that's a totally separate issue. It's because of that foundation that you had the private small-scale production emerging in the mid-90s, growing rapidly in the countryside. Yeah, peasants, so they worked in their assigned agricultural cooperative, and then they went into the mountains and worked their own plot that they forged out of nothing. They forged out of rocks. They even used the equipment from inactive factories, shut down farms, to produce, to create new markets. Sometimes they stole what they needed to actually make it productive elsewhere outside of state control. They were taking shut down factories during this crisis period, selling the metal as scrap to the Chinese and using that money to then, not for their own purposes, but to plow into actual productive capital. Of course, you're going to have growing class differences, but not like we're talking about in the U.S., Now, you did have maybe 500,000 leaving North Korea. They became migrant workers in China. The border wasn't very well policed at the time. But the ration gaps were filled up by these family-based and regional-based markets. And these entities, these new organizations of capital, for lack of a better phrase, by 2000, 2001, They are, in fact, the main actors of North Korean economic life. Yes, of course you're going to have class distinctions. Some people are simply better than others at this kind of productive capital, businessmen. So long as it deals with production, it's okay. We're not talking about merchants. The merchant class only exists if it's a part of production. Not just, you know, they don't have Jews in North Korea to distort this kind of thing. Their merchant class is productive because it's a part of the productive economy. They're middlemen only to the extent that middlemen are necessary in terms of building a rational economy. So, of course, you're still going to get, you know, this growth in commodity production. You're going to have a new class of comparatively rich families that continue to exist now, started to really come into their own by 2005. But you're talking about a family that makes, let's say, $200,000 a year versus a family that makes $40,000 a year. Obviously, that's not the inequality that we're dealing with in the U.S. Capitalism always tends to centralization, but only if that middleman, that Jewish mentality, continues to distort it. That doesn't exist where you have a very strong sense of racial and national trust and a homogenous society. But still, if left to their own, wealth begets more wealth unless the state acts. Now, as it stands, North Korea's laws don't provide for these very important, in fact, now critical economic units. So instead, they simply followed what became traditional contract law without actually having contract law. These were informal contracts with local bureaucrats who then pretended that the enterprise was state-owned. So it was a very simple way to deal with it. A certain amount of the product would be paid by the owner of the new enterprise to the state, while the rest was taken as private income. So that means that any official salary that someone may have, especially out in the countryside, is just one source of income out of potentially several. And I think for this reason, to the extent that the state still maintains its hands-off policy towards this new movement, especially in the northern part of the country, in the mountains, Kim Jong-un will remain popular. His father was not popular. You do have some economic success in North Korea, and it comes from the existence of this private sector. And all the leader has to do is to do nothing about it. And some of these people are even being brought into the capital, engaging in these new micro-districts in Pyongyang, Hamhung, and places like that, other cities in the north. So 10 years ago, say, the entire consumer sector, the majority of restaurants, retail shops, fishing, even things like inner-city freight, transport, they were privatized. It's emerged even in large-scale light industry or consumer industry. Restaurants, catering in the capital, about 80% are in private hands in 2025. They just simply use a state name to give it the impression that it's under state control. You can't really call this capitalism in the sense that we may use the term referring to the Western experience. That's not necessarily a bad thing, of course. These weren't subversive or revolutionary changes at all. There's something these are things that came into existence at a time of severe crisis, that these were, in fact, spontaneous growths of collective markets, and they changed slowly over time. The state didn't interfere with it. Even if you have some people who, like, say, in 2010, let me a little bit afterwards, you had some in the party who wanted to eradicate this, to return everything to central planning, but anyone with a brain knew that this was largely impossible. Juche is this mishmash of, like, semi-Maoism connected to Korean nationalism. Now, the thing that you have to keep in mind is that these new private entities, they don't conform to Western models. These are neither normal in the Western sense, nor are they Western. So when you're trying to talk about comparative poverty or wealth, it's extremely difficult to do compared with the ROK versus the DPRK. The most optimistic will hold that right now, when it comes just to straight income, it's like 10 times the ROK over the DPRK. That is not, however, adjusted for purchasing power parity. since the extreme differences in the two systems make comparison almost impossible. What does $200 in North Korea mean versus $200 in Seoul? $200 a month in South Korea, in the capital city, say, or a place like Incheon or whatever, that would be impoverishment. In North Korea, $200 a month is not being impoverished. Government subsidies, taxes, infrastructure, the nature of things like healthcare and education, where the money comes from, where it goes, class structure, all of this is extremely important in figuring out exactly how far $200 a month is going to go. Now, keep something else in mind. The way that Western policymakers look at this, they figure, well, if the North Korean state eases up, what's going to happen is that these new capitalist entities are going to explode in a French Revolutionary style movement. That would overthrow the Korean Workers' Party. Well, the problem with that is that there are no vacuums here. It's not so much that these people will eventually think of for themselves as this nonsense cliche, but there are no vacuums. It's either the state, the way we understand it from Pyongyang now, or Western propaganda. It's going to be one of the two. There are no vacuums. The last thing in the world any country can rely on is hopes. And this is where the media, in creating these inflated, unfounded expectations, can cause destruction. North Korea has said unification with the South is now simply out of the question. They're not going to seek war, but they know that they're probably going to win a war, all other things being equal. We know the demographic problem in South Korea and what it has come to mean in 2025. You know, you've seen the meme, right? You know, North Korea looking at the South imploding on itself, and the North had nothing to do with it. You have something very different developing in North Korea than you did, say, in the Jewish oligarchy in Ukraine and Russia, starting, let's say, in 1991, 1992. There's not going to be any unification with the South, and that really no one has any interest in this, both whether the bureaucracy of the DPRK, as well as these new capitalist enterprises, who certainly couldn't compete with the Southern millionaires and billionaires, many of whom are connected with Western banks in the first place, especially since 1997. The ROK is dealing with political instability, a dwindling population, both of which comes from Western influence. The ROK is stagnant economically. You know, the regime uses stupid things like, you know, they try to avoid using the word depression by using rounding errors to claim like there's a 0.001% growth, so they don't have to say zero or negative, so they can avoid using words like depression. And you notice this only came into existence once the U.S. ousted the military from power in Seoul, or Taipei for that matter. It only took 10, 15 years for their miracle to come crashing down in 1997 after the military government was overthrown by the U.S., the great General Chung Hee Park murdered by the CIA, both the Korean and the American. But the economic slowdown in the ROK is not politically based. The ROK has a huge trade deficit with China, and the Chinese are not pleased with South Korea's subservience to the violent and expansionist American empire. The family unit, just like any place liberalism goes, is under attack. Few babies are being born. There's not a huge hope for the future in Korea. And yet, in the DPRK, these new formations of capital, they're young, they're fresh, they're ambitious, and they're based on national socialism, not this Judaic materialism. The Chinese model makes a lot more sense than anything that the West provides, because the West provides absolutely nothing. Militarily speaking, we know what the problem is. The demonization of North Korea by the Western media has stood by its government in the DPRK. You have the benefit of a compact, homogenous population, ideologically committed, very well educated, especially in the sciences, that as of now can resist liberal corruption. Things like internet propaganda and pornography, which are banned in places like this. But as many others have mentioned before me, it required the near total military mobilization of the country to fight back. But you can't deny that the DPRK has been successful, being a fairly small country. And it shows you just how powerful ethnic homogeneity truly is, socially speaking. It's been able to fight not just in economically, but in terms of electronic warfare, information warfare, escalation management, all of this stuff. And Abrams' book, which I recommend to you, recent developments between North Korea and Russia can be understood. The State Duma has ratified the new strategic partnership, which came from the visits in June of last year, creating a NATO-style, all-for-one kind of ideology. Treaties that make a stand against Western sanctions and opens the very small but very real Russian-Korean border, North Korean border, for free movement of all persons and commodities. Of course, the North Korean-Chinese border is much larger. There is a minuscule border. If you look at it on a map, you need a magnifying glass to see it between Russia and North Korea, but it's there. But along with the trade between North Korea and China, Western sanctions have been completely defeated. North Korea has taken measures to seal and fortify its border with the South. So as the South possibly will lash out, although I don't know with what, in the sense of having any kind of natural, I mean, it is basically homogenous as well, but that's not ideological like it is in the North. There'll be no ground attack from that direction if the West wants to, deliberately provoke it. In fact, the 21st century North Korea has been the one source of stability around which the axis of resistance can continue to develop. And Abrams' book, Surviving the Unipolar Era, North Korea 35-Year Standoff with the United States, that goes far in explaining to us how this has all come to pass. And I do recommend it. Not everything in there I agree with, but it goes a long way in explaining how this can be done without necessarily accepting every single thing that Pyongyang does domestically. I don't have full agreement with anybody, including myself, half the time. But the one thing we do know is that the media is so deeply corrupt that the North Korean response to it may be the only way out in 2025. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.